Law and Grace, Chapter 11, Part B, Privilege and Responsibility. The covenant land, as we have seen, was intended to be, like the sanctuary, a dwelling place simultaneously for God and for his people. Therefore, only if Israel proved fit for God to dwell among them could they qualify to retain their tenancy of his land. The murder laws made their contribution toward the education of the nation in this respect, but they were not alone in this. It was, in fact, the land and harvest laws which made the biggest contribution of all. One of these struck the keynote of Israel's duty as tenants of God's land at the very outset of their tenancy. So important was the lesson which it brought home to the people that the special ritual which it prescribed had to be repeated to enable the lesson to be reiterated at the same season every year thereafter. The Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye come into the land whither I bring you, then it shall be that when ye eat of the bread of the land, ye shall offer up a cake of the first of your dough for a heave offering, as ye do the heave offering of a threshing floor, so shall ye heave it. Of the first of your dough ye shall give unto the Lord an heave offering in your generations. There is an obvious similarity between the ritual of the sheaf of first fruits and this of the cake made from the first of the dough, or more correctly, coarse meal, as the revised margin has it. There are, however, certain significant differences. Like the loaves of first fruits, the cake of coarse meal was the yield of harvest in edible form. Secondly, the sheaf and the loaves were wave offerings, giving prominence to the notion of consecration, whereas the cake was a heave offering, that is, an offering made direct to God as sovereign Lord. The law specified, Of the first of your dough ye shall give unto the Lord an heave offering. That is, the notion of offering something to God as his due was the distinctive feature of the symbolism. What had Israel to give to God on this occasion? Literally, it was a cake of coarse meal. We have now to decide what this symbolized. The nature of the meal gives us the clue. This was not fine flour, such as only a small proportion of the people would eat in the ordinary course, but coarse meal. That is the staple diet of the mass of the nation. It's everyday food and staff of life. It thus clearly stood for the ordinary workaday life of the people. And the ritual declared that of this, the first portion, and so the whole, had to be acknowledged as God's. In presenting the cake to God, the nation was acknowledging that its tenancy of the land demanded no less than the entire giving of itself, day by day, to God, to whom the land belonged. It had to make this ritual confession for the first time, as soon as it was practicable to do so, namely upon the reaping of the very first harvest in the land. But it had to renew it each time a fresh harvest was reaped, year after year, because of its fundamental importance. The terms of the law suggest that the cake was a national offering and that in all probability it was presented as part of a public service. Assent to the meaning of the ritual had, however, to be given personally by every individual Israelite. And this was made possible by yet another rite of similar significance. The law declared, in addition, It shall be, when thou art come in unto the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance, and possessest it, and dwellest therein, that thou shalt take of the first of all the fruit of the earth, which thou shalt bring of thy land that the Lord thy God giveth thee, and shall put it in a basket, and shall go unto the place which the Lord thy God shall choose to place his name there. Arriving at the sanctuary, the offerer had first to say, in the hearing of the priest, I profess this day unto the Lord thy God, that I am come unto the country which the Lord sware unto our fathers for to give us. The priest then put the basket on the ground before the altar and heard the offerer make formal confession of the blessings of the covenant and of their undeserved nature, ending with the words, And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which thou, O Lord, hast given me. The significance of the ritual was obvious. Each Israelite had individually to avow that he had no right to his inheritance, that he enjoyed it solely by God's grace, that its fruits all really belonged to God, not to himself. In presenting his basket of first fruits, he is in fact pledged to requite God for his mercy by the total dedication of his life and service to him. And when in fulfillment of his pledge he duly brought his triennial offering of tithes to the sanctuary, he had to declare publicly that he had brought all that he should and withheld nothing whatever, in obedience to the Lord's command, and then invoke God's promised blessing upon his people and land for his obedience as a representative of the people as a whole. The nature of the covenant necessitated such confessions of dependence upon God and of readiness to serve him from those who enjoyed its benefits. The offerers in the Mass, Moses could say, Thou hast avouched the Lord this day to be thy God. Conversely, of God, he could say, And the Lord hath avouched thee this day to be his peculiar people, and to remind them of the moral obligations of their calling, he added, That Thou mayest be an holy people unto the Lord thy God, as he hath spoken. To stress that great fact, the law also arranged that each individual Israelite should come to see an objective representation of himself in the produce of the soil which he cultivated. When ye shall come into the land, and shall have planted all manner of trees for food, then shall ye count the fruits thereof as uncircumcised. 3 years shall it be as uncircumcised unto you. It shall not be eaten of, but in the fourth year all the fruit thereof shall be holy to praise the Lord withal. And in the fifth year shall ye eat the fruit thereof, that it may yield unto you the increase thereof. I am the Lord your God. For 7 days after birth, the husbandman himself, though lineally descended from Abraham, had stood outside the covenant. Then, on the eighth day, he had become one of God's people, his circumcision being witness of the fact and of its spiritual meaning. Thereafter, he was under the obligation to live only and wholly for God. Each tree he planted was to remind him of these great facts. For 3 years after planting, none of its fruit was to be picked. It was outside the covenant, uncircumcised, and thus not fit to feed a member of the covenant people. On the fourth year, however, it was to become God's. The whole of its fruits that year being in token of that fact, counted as holy to praise the Lord. This fourth year's yield, the first of its yield as a circumcised tree, that is, stood representatively for that of each succeeding year also, but it sufficed for the allegorical purpose involved that this one year's yield should be the only one made over to God in its entirety. This arrangement made it abundantly clear to the pious Israelite that the fruit of his spiritual activity before God had all to be holy and to praise the Lord with all. Having ritually assented that God's claims came first and in all things took precedence over his own, he could thereafter, in humility and gratitude, use the yield of his tree for the sustenance of his mortal life. In the fifth year shall ye eat the fruit thereof, that it may yield unto you the increase thereof. I am the Lord your God. In the fifth year, not before, that is God first, man next. And why? Because I am the Lord thy God. That was the momentous fact which gave such weight and meaning to the ritual and reinforced its claims upon the people to be as holy as the land in which they dwelt and as their God, whose habitation it was beside their own. The fact that land and people were parallel types is nowhere more evident than in the ritual of the Sabbath year. In the case of man, a day is a complete cycle of activity. In the case of agricultural land, it is a year. Now, in Israel's case, the land was covenant land. Therefore, in the same way as the people had to rest one day in seven, the land had to lie fallow one year in seven. When ye come into the land which I give you, then shall the land keep the Sabbath unto the Lord. This law held good for field, orchard, and vineyard alike. Nothing was to be systematically harvested, for it is a year of rest unto the land. What grew of itself could be eaten, but not garnered or treated as the exclusive possession of the owner. The Sabbath of the land shall be meat for you, for thee and for thy servant and for thy maid and for thy hired servant and for thy stranger that sojourneth with thee and for thy cattle and for the beast that are in thy land, shall all the increase thereof be meat. We note that apart from the resting of the land, this law brought great benefit to the distressed and the landless. The seventh year was to be a period of kindness and generous service to others, and a reminder that each man's inheritance, though his own possession which he had every right to guard most jealously, was something to be held in trust as a means of serving others' needs beside his own. This same lesson was inculcated with regularity in each of the other 6 years out of the seven by the harvest law, which decreed, when ye reap the harvest of your land, thou shalt not make clean riddance of the corners of thy field when thou reapest, neither shalt thou gather any gleaning of thy harvest. Thou shalt leave them unto the poor and to the stranger. Why? Once again, for the all-sufficient reason, I am the Lord your God. This solemn pronouncement reminded the Israelite that the blessings which he himself enjoyed were undeserved. What he himself freely received, he was freely to give. A dropped sheaf was not to be retrieved from the field, but left for the needy. There was to be no parsimonious beating of the boughs of his olive tree, but rather the reverse, so that fruit should still remain on it, for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. Each Israelite had to realize that God had loved him and done great things for him. He had therefore to love the Lord his God in return. But if that was his first and overriding duty, there was a second like unto it, as the harvest laws made plain, to love his neighbour as himself. Each year, as we have seen, taught this same great lesson. The seventh year merely taught it more emphatically to match the stress which it placed upon the idea of redemptive rest. We've had an illustration of that stress in that other far-reaching law which had to be observed most strictly. At the end of every 7 years, thou shalt make a release. And this is the manner of the release. Every creditor that lendeth aught unto his neighbour shall release it. He shall not exact it of his neighbour or of his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. The arrangement was a salutary check on avarice in the creditor and afforded him an opportunity to appreciate what a boon was his generosity to the poor man who benefited by it. God had taken pity on his distress in Egypt, and so the nearness of the year of release was not to induce meanness in him or disregard of his brother's need. Thou shalt not harden thine heart, nor shut thine hand from thy poor brother, but thou shalt open thine hand wide unto him, and lend him sufficient for his need in that which he wanteth. The command was attended by a warning. If he proved guilty of Pharaoh's hard-heartedness, God would hear his brother's cry, as he had heard Israel's in Egypt, and requite his sin as he had requited Pharaoh's. The fact that his debtor was one who had been given release from Egyptian bondage entitled him to generous treatment by his richer brother, as well as to all the privileges of the Lord's release. Only of a foreigner thou mayest exact it again, but that which is thine with thy brother, thine hand shall release. Such meat could be given away after the occupation of the land for consumption by the resident stranger, or sold to the alien. But no Israelite was to eat it, for thou art an holy people unto the Lord thy God. Circumstances might change and warrant some modification of the statutes of the Book of the Covenant, but nothing would alter the holiness of Israel's calling, and the realization of it was always to regulate the behavior of one member of the covenant people toward another. The coincidence of the Sabbath year and the year of release cannot be proved textually, but in view of their symbolic significance, there's clearly no need to do so. It is self-evident, and it is no violation of our working rules to regard it as axiomatic. On that account, poverty would tend to be more widespread than in normal years, and the Lord's release would be a very necessary measure to mitigate suffering, to help preserve the sabbatical character of the year. It would mean, too, that the Feast of Tabernacles would be without much of its usual gaiety. The release from Egyptian bondage would still be celebrated by the normal joyous 7 years dwelling in booths, 7 days dwelling in booths. But after a year without normal harvest, the feast would lack some of its ordinary features, despite the plentiful harvest of the previous year, in accordance with the divine promise. Many would undoubtedly be preoccupied as the people had been in the wilderness with the meat that perisheth. The law made special provision for the fact, it would seem, for it decreed at the end of every 7 years, in the solemnity of the year of release, in the Feast of Tabernacles, thou shalt read this law before all Israel in their hearing, that they may learn and fear the Lord your God, and observe to do all the words of this law. No season or year could have been fitter for this ceremony. None were better qualified either than the Levites to do the reading. And doubtless on the analogy of Nehemiah 8, the instructing which went with it. The moral was plain and offset the anxieties of the people, teaching them that man doth not live by bread only, but by every word that proceedeth out of the mouth of the Lord doth man live. The year of Jubilee. As we have already had occasion to see, like everything else in the law, the calendar made use of a climactic symbolism. That symbolism reached its culmination every 50th year. This was the year of release, par excellence. After a cycle of seven-year periods had elapsed, the great 50th year was ushered into the accompaniment of trumpet blasts throughout the length and breadth of the land. These probably began at the sanctuary and radiated outwards as each trumpeter in succession caught the sound of the notes made by the trumpeter next nearest to the sanctuary. In this way, the message that the 50th year had begun doubtless reached the outer confines of the land within a matter of minutes. Immediately the notes were heard. All who were dispossessed or enslaved recovered their rights and liberties automatically. The poor man who had sold his inheritance had sold it only on lease to his new owner. At any stage he had the right to redeem it because it was no one's but his own. And even though he were to poor to redeem it, or could find none of his wealthy kinsmen to redeem it for him, it now reverted to him without qualification on the opening of this 50th year. Ye shall hallow the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land unto all the inhabitants thereof. It shall be a jubilee unto you, and ye shall return every man unto his possession, and ye shall return every man unto his family. The slave Hebrew likewise received his freedom back, and was at liberty to return unto his own family and unto the possession of his fathers, so that he might enjoy the estate which had once more become his. This was Sabbath year of Sabbath years. Land and people alike belong to God in the ultimate sense. The land is mine, was his pronouncement regarding Canaan. All the firstborn are mine, was the corresponding claim which he made upon the nation. He intended the one to be the free inheritance of the other, and both alike to be a dwelling place for him. The 50th year was but the preeminent reminder to the nation of this fact. It was superlatively the year of rest, both recalling the original occupation of the land after the toilsome sojourn in the wilderness, and at the same time anticipating that glorious future era, when the nation would at last attain to its ideal destiny and enter into the perfect rest, symbolized by the inner sanctuary of the most holy place. It was in fact a new beginning, like every other 8th year, and also like each 8th day in the calendar. It spoke of newness of life, and also of perfection of service. It is the Jubilee. It shall be holy unto you. Rest and holiness. For Israel, these were meant to be twin notions. Because God had redeemed them, they had to be a holy nation before him. So fittingly, this great year of Jubilee, which was to remind them of this in such signal fashion, began not on the first day of Abib, but on a day of far greater symbolical import still, the Day of Days, in fact. Thou shalt number 7 Sabbaths of years unto thee, then shalt thou cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, in the Day of Atonement shall ye make the trumpet sound throughout all your land. The trumpet at the central sanctuary was obviously sounded when Aaron emerged from the tabernacle after the presentation of the atoning blood of the bullock and goat of sin offering, and signalized the departure of the scapegoat as it bore Israel's iniquities away from the face of God. Its notes and the echoes of it, as they reverberated throughout the land, thus spoke of sins forgiven, of iniquities pardoned, the transgressions hid, and so of rest from sin and all its bondage. And they were thus a tremendously forceful reminder to all who wished to attain to the ultimate eternal rest of which they spoke, that they could not so attain unless they ceased from sin, not only that year, but also every other year besides. They had been redeemed for that express purpose. Blessed indeed were they who thus heard the joyful sound. How unutterably tragic, therefore, was their failure to manifest that holiness which God demanded of them.